No one has been more influential to the field of economics than Adam Smith. His 18th century writings and ideas have been unpacked, debated, and sometimes, some say, simply misunderstood. Take, for instance, The Invisible Hand.
Smith was describing the conditions under which capitalism would work, right, in essence. And it got understood instead as a promise that capitalism would just magically work.
In this episode, how the misinterpretation of a simple turn of phrase from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations skewed mid-20th century thinking about economic freedom.
You know, I think we are seeing throughout the Western world now a real loss of credibility from the folks who do possess a lot of useful technological knowledge that they could bring to bear, because unfortunately they buried it under an ideology that has proven false. My name is Oren Kass. I am the founder and chief economist at American Compass, and we are a think tank based in Washington working on conservative economic policy and moving the right of center away from libertarian, what we would call market fundamentalism, and back toward a more genuinely conservative approach to economics.
Kass is also the author of In Search of the Invisible Hand, published in the March edition of Finance and Development magazine.
So I wonder, just to kick us off here, if I could ask you, you know, to just read what Adam Smith actually wrote in that one reference to The Invisible Hand in The Wealth of Nations, if you have it in front of you or close by.
I do. Don't go anywhere without it.
Okay.
Well, what Smith said was, by preferring the support of domestic to that of foreign industry, he intends only his own security. And by directing that industry in such a manner as its produce may be of the greatest value, he intends only his own gain. And he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention.
That's great. First of all, is there anything novel in this idea that Adam Smith was expressing in that, in the 18th century? Is there anything in that sentence that would have been surprising to economists at the time, do you think?
Well, I think there is. And it's important to remember there, in fact, was no such thing as an economist at the time.
Hmm.
even I think Smith was called a political economist. And, you know, the very notion of markets, of a capitalist system was only just emerging. And I think the best way to understand Smith, and frankly, to understand economists throughout history, is that what they are really doing is understanding and describing the world around them and trying to make sense of what in fact is happening. Mm. And so the idea that in fact markets could work, that you could have people just off pursuing their own profit and yet the society would gain, was not something that was part of most people's conception. And so to explain that no, this actually can work and here's how and why, was enormously valuable and influential.
So today, when we hear economists talking about this invisible hand, it's suggesting that markets essentially can take care of themselves, which is an interpretation that happened at some point. But this does not seem to jive with what Smith was saying at all. So how did we go from an idea that sounds to me more like industrial policy to this free market logic that the invisible hand is associated with today?
Well, I think it's a pattern that you see in all sorts of ideas and ultimately ideologies all the time. And that's why I always emphasize, you know, when I use the term market fundamentalism to describe what has become of free market economic thinking, I guess it sounds somewhat derogatory or derisive, but I mean it in a very descriptive sense. It is quite typical to see ideologies harden over time and nuanced points become reinterpreted in both ways that are simpler and that give the people expounding them more power. And that's how you end up with a religious fundamentalism as well, that often, you know, misappropriates, in a sense, an original text to advance a much more absolutist vision. And I think that's what we've seen happen with economics, that particularly on the right of center, but also certainly plenty of economists on the sort of center left have tried to claim for themselves a sort of special, almost mystical knowledge about what markets are and how they work, and have tried to build a frame around that knowledge in which these markets are somewhat magical and must simply be left alone. Or at least if not, they may only be interfered with in the special ways that only economists can understand. And one sees why both it is a very appealing thing to think for many people, and certainly why it has been in the interests of the economics profession to advance it. But it's not true. And it has, I think, caused a great deal of damage in countries like the United States that have suffered a great deal in their economies as a result.
So you write in your FND piece that it was actually after MIT published a piece in the late 40s in their technical review that included some text from Paul Samuelson that seemed to be sort of like the first sign of this misrepresentation of Smith's words. How did he frame it, and where did it go from there?
Well, it's not just from a technical review. It was Samuelson in the textbook Economics, which was the sort of seminal textbook for teaching economics for much of the 20th century, in which, you know, Samuelson essentially with the use of an ellipse wipes out all of these conditions about the support of domestic over foreign industry, about the directing industry to produce that of greatest value, and instead shortens it to essentially be that the person who is intending only his own security and his own gain, led by an invisible hand, promotes an end which was no part of his intention. And so what began with Smith as a statement under the conditions in which markets can work became an assertion that they somehow automatically would. And I think you see this a lot in the mid-century, really sort of post-World War II, early Cold War era, when a great deal of the fight was about markets versus central planning. And, you know, Hayek is another person who has sort of taken the invisible hand concept and elevated it to this idea of a self-regulating market, as he liked to call it. And somewhat as in Smith's time, there were a lot of people who were saying, well, wait a minute, how could our free and messy markets possibly hope to compete with the Stalinist central planning that is just going to set its goal and orient the society in its pursuit? And so, again, I think Western economists, probably in a very well-meaning way, were wanting to convey the idea, no, there is actually reason to believe that the market system can outperform the central planning system. And of course, that is true. It can and it does. But those shortcuts taken along the way in conveying that proof to a much more sort of popular and political audience had the result of distorting, I think, our politics and our policy debates in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I find, how Hayek kind of runs with that interpretation of the invisible hand, because Hayek and Smith are seen to have kind of opposing views on markets and the role of government. And it seems Hayek's whole ethos is kind of based on this misrepresentation of Smith's idea, no?
Well, I think Hayek almost builds to it independently. You know, I think Hayek is less misinterpreting Smith than simply advancing his own obviously incorrect theory.
Right.
But it's exactly right that, you know, Hayek, and strikingly, he advances this most directly in a piece that was literally titled "Why I Am Not a Conservative." Mm-hmm. And he was very frustrated by these conservatives who were not showing sufficient faith that the market would surely sort of its own volition just come to the right answer, even if no one could understand or predict how. And I think that's a really important point to remember in understanding some of the debates going on in politics, in economics, today, where we've come to think of conservative economics as kind of right of center thinking, as being this, you know, very strong, almost market fundamentalist commitment to markets, skepticism of government. But that was never conservative. There is nothing conservative about it. Certainly conservatives prefer limited government, but they're not going around placing blind faith in markets or, you know, believing that tax cuts will solve all our problems. Mm-hmm. And so what I think you're seeing is in a sense a defenestration of that kind of thinking out of the conservative movement and out of the right of center, certainly in the United States, but across a lot of the Western world. And the big question then is, okay, well then what replaces it? Because conservatives have sort of outsourced their economic thinking to libertarians for so long that their muscles have really atrophied in this regard. And wow. And reclaiming, you know, redeveloping that idea of, okay, what does it mean to apply conservative principles to our economic challenges is what we're doing now.
So what do you think the result has been really? I mean, you've just described something here about where we're at in terms of our economies and you mentioned earlier, yes, it can work and it does work, but not always. And so how do we make sure that things don't fall apart when it's not working? And so what do you think the result has been of this spin on Smith's idea?
Yeah, I think, you know, where the rubber meets the road on how this misinterpretation, in a sense, has played out is that Smith was describing the conditions under which capitalism would work, right, in essence. And it got understood instead as a promise that capitalism would just magically work. Mm. And what Smith was talking about that was so important, that the conditions he was focused on were those that are necessary to ensure that there is some alignment between private profit and the public interest. So if you think about those conditions he focuses on, support of domestic rather than foreign industry, directing industry such that his produce may be of the greatest value, the point is that if those are the ways to generate profit for yourself, investing domestically in production of the greatest value, then your pursuit of your own profit will also be socially beneficial. And what happened when we lost sight of that requirement and instead sort of just assumed that whatever anybody does to pursue profit will be socially beneficial is we started loosening constraints and accepting choices where that clearly did not hold. And so, you know, one obvious one is with globalization and the offshoring of production. And saying, well, actually, what happens if the best way to earn a lot of money is to shut down American factories and move them overseas? It is obvious to the ordinary person that that is not good for America. It would be obvious to Adam Smith that that is not good for America. But under the misinterpretation, it was assumed that, well, if that's what the market is doing, if that's where the highest profit is, then that must be what's good for America. And by the way, we now have to reverse engineer a sort of absurd on its face explanation for how that would be good for America, which sort of discredits the whole project in the process. And then I think you see the same thing with respect to the produce of greatest value, particularly when it comes to, you know, financialization in the economy, the increasing focus on operating businesses as financial assets that could simply be, you know, chopped apart, levered up with debt, merged together, traded in circles. And the idea that if the people on Wall Street and if the investors were earning a lot of money, well, then that must mean that whatever they were doing was actually good and valuable. When again, in fact, that's not true. If the way you're making profit is not correlated to producing that of greatest value, then there's no reason to believe that your profit and pursuit of it is going to be aligned with the common good. And so we ended up with this world where the corporate sector, where investors, where managers were increasingly pursuing profit in unproductive ways, And rather than saying, wait a minute, this isn't going to go well,
right.
We built an entire edifice of theory and ideology, frankly, for why this will be fine and is going to go well. Mm-hmm. And of course, in fact, it has not gone well. And the people who were saying it would are kind of left out in the cold.
And that's, that's interesting because in the past, a couple of years, I'd say, especially, you hear people talking about the end of globalization and that, you know, that it has benefited too narrow a slice of society. So with this misinterpretation of Adam Smith's idea and how that has played into the form of capitalism that we're seeing today, do you see Adam Smith essentially being blamed for the shortcomings of globalization, even though, you know, what he was saying originally was misinterpreted?
Well, I think there's certainly some of that. I think there's, you know, more broadly just a frustration with capitalism and with markets, which is unfortunate because capitalism and markets have, in fact, proven themselves repeatedly to be the best system anyone has thought of for achieving the things we do want, for producing widespread prosperity.
Right.
And so, you know, in a sense, I think, you know, we call a lot of our work at American Compass, it's under the heading of rebuilding American capitalism, of the idea that, you know, where the libertarian free market right went was to this blind faith that has been very unproductive. But you don't want to correct for that by going to the sort of progressive view that, well, you see, capitalism just doesn't work.
Right.
What you need to actually go back is understand under what conditions will capitalism work. And I think, you know, that's where something like globalization is actually a great place to focus, because on one hand, it's important to say trade can be a wonderful thing, right? If it's actually working the way, you know, people like Adam Smith and David Ricardo wrote about it, then absolutely it can benefit the people of both countries participating. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if just to throw in one other quote from Smith, also from The Wealth of Nations, it's very interesting to look at his basic description of trade. What he says is, if a foreign country can supply us with a commodity cheaper than we ourselves can make it, better buy it of them with some part of the produce of our own industry. Mm. So, in other words, the trade that he was talking about, and Ricardo and John Stuart Mill talk in the exact same terms, recognize that this works because it is actually trade of something you are making for something someone else is making.
Yeah.
And so if there were a bunch of factories that had been in the United States that were being closed down and moved overseas because there were some other set of factories that were going to expand here, there were some things we were better at and we were going to do more of that and trade it for the things that someone else could do better, that probably would have worked out quite well for the United States. But what we did instead, again, under this kind of theory of self-regulating markets, was to just say, this is fine if we don't make anything at all. If the profit maximizing thing is for all of the production to happen in China and to run, you know, what is now $1 trillion a year trade deficit, where other countries supply us with a commodity cheaper than we ourselves can make it, but we don't buy it with some part of the produce of our own industry. We buy it with our assets. We buy it with our debt, with pieces of paper saying we will pay you for it some other time. Obviously, that's not going to work. And and all of the classical economists who are cited for the premise, you know, for the proposition that this is a good idea, all of them said this will not work. And we are all now paying the price and have been for a while. And I think the good news is that the economics profession is starting to pay the price too. We are now beginning to undergo that rethinking, and hopefully it's not too late.
And so finally, to what extent do you think the current political landscape has been shaped or at least influenced by this misinterpretation of Adam Smith's idea?
Well, I think it was very badly misshaped over the past generation. You know, if you go back to, for instance, the 2000 American presidential election, it was basically between George W. Bush and Al Gore falling over themselves to more enthusiastically embrace China and welcome it into the global trading system. And you went through an entire generation where globalization, where financialization, where this approach to markets was quite broadly embraced across the political spectrum. There were certainly elements of the left and you know, those affiliated with labor and so forth who were more skeptical. Yeah. There were some on the right who were making more genuinely conservative arguments. But by and large, they were just shouted down as you know, knuckle-dragging, mouth-breathing Neanderthals who could not, you know, simply could not understand the wisdom and brilliance of this blind faith in markets. And I think, you know, obviously part of the consequence of that was substantive in the many things that have gone so wrong. But it also has had real political consequences. It has greatly fueled a populism that says, in fact, we do not trust the experts because, frankly, they don't deserve to be trusted. And so, you know, I think we are seeing throughout the Western world now a real loss of credibility from the folks who do possess a lot of useful technological knowledge that they could bring to bear because, unfortunately, they buried it under an ideology that has proven false. And so I think, you know, we are now in the middle of an era of upheaval. Hopefully what emerges from it is a new and better economic consensus. You know, at American Compass, our mission is to restore an economic consensus that emphasizes the importance of family, community, and industry to the nation's liberty and prosperity. Because, of course, that was the consensus until this past generation. You know, just as one example, the Republican Party was always the party of tariffs. Yeah. You know, the United States grew into the industrial colossus that it was behind probably the world's highest protectionist barriers. And so it's not necessarily that we have to sort of invent anything entirely new. It's that we have to recognize and understand what's wrong with this anachronistic view that took hold, throw it out, and then build from much better ideas, something that will be applicable to the 21st century.
How interesting. Orrin Kass is the founder and chief economist of American Compass. Thanks so much.
Well, this was great. Thank you.
Look for Orrin Kass's article, In Search of the Invisible Hand, in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.